Buy herself time. Buy Adian time. You don't get to decide when and where and how you meet him, Aelin said.
He's my god's damned son. I think I do.
Aelin shrugged. You don't even get to decide if you're allowed to call him that. Those tawny eyes flashed, the tattooed hands curled into fists. But Rowan said,
Gavriel, she does not intend to keep you from him. Tell me where my son is. Now.
Ah, there it was. The face of the lion. The warrior who had felled armies, whose reputation made wintered soldiers shudder, whose fallen warriors were tattooed all over him. But Aelin picked at her nails, then frowned at the now empty hall behind her. Hell if I know where he's gone off to. They blinked, then started, as they beheld where Lysandra had once been, to where she had now vanished, flying or slithering or crawling out of the open window, to get Adian away. Aelin just said to Gavriel, her voice flat and cold, Don't ever give me orders. Adian and Lysandra were already waiting at the Ocean Rose, and as they entered the pretty courtyard, Aelin barely dragged up the energy to remark to Rowan that she was shocked he hadn't opted for warrior squalor. Dorian, a few steps behind, laughed quietly, which was good, she supposed. Good that he was laughing. He had not been the last time she saw him, and it had been weeks since she'd laughed herself, felt that weight lift long enough to do so. She gave Rowan a look that told him to meet her upstairs, and halted halfway across the courtyard. Dorian, sensing her intent, paused as well. The evening air was heavy with sweet fruit and climbing flowers, the fountain in the center gurgling softly. She wondered if the owner of the inn hailed from the Red Desert, if they'd seen the use of water and stone and greenery at the Keep of the Silent Assassins. But Aelin murmured to Dorian, I'm sorry about Rifthold. The king's summer-tanned face tightened.
Thank you for the help.
Aelin shrugged. Rowan's always looking for an excuse to show off. Dramatic rescues give him purpose and fulfillment in his dull, immortal life. There was a pointed cough from the open balcony doors above them, sharp enough to inform her that Rowan had heard and wouldn't forget that little quip when they were alone. She held in her smile. It had been a surprise and a delight, she supposed, that an easy, respectful calm flowed between Rowan and Dorian on their walk over here. She motioned for the king to continue with her, and said quietly, well aware of how many spies Rolf employed within the building, It seems you and I are currently without crowns, thanks to a few bullshit pieces of paper. Dorian didn't return her smile. The stairs groaned beneath them as they headed for the second floor. They were almost to the room Dorian had indicated when he said,
Maybe that's a good thing.
She opened and closed her mouth, and opted, for once, to keep quiet, shaking her head a bit as she entered the chamber. Their meeting was hushed, thorough. Rowan and Dorian laid out in precise detail what had happened to them, Adian pushing for counts of the witches, their armor, how they flew, what formations they used. Anything to feed to the Bane, to amplify their northern defenses, regardless of who commanded them. The General of the North, who would take all those pieces and build their resistance. But the sheer ease with which the Iron Teeth Legion had taken the city.
Manon Blackbeak, Adian mused,
would be a valuable ally if we can get her to turn.
Aelin glanced at Rowan's shoulder, where a faint scar now marred the golden skin beneath his clothes. Perhaps getting Manon to turn on her kin would ignite an internal battle among the witches, she said. Maybe they'll save us the task of killing them and just destroy each other. Dorian straightened in his chair, but only cold calculations swirled in his eyes as he countered.
But what is it that they want? Beyond our heads, I mean. Why ally with Erewhon at all?
And all of them then looked to the thin necklace of scars marring the base of Aelin's throat, where the scent permanently marked her as a witch-killer. Baba Yellowlegs had visited the castle this winter for that alliance, but had there been anything else? "We can contemplate the whys and hows of it later," Aelin declared. "If we encounter any of the witches, we take them alive. I want some questions answered." Then she explained what they'd witnessed in Ilium, the order Brannan had given her. Find the lock. Well, he and his little quest could get in line. It was never-ending, she supposed, while they dined that night on peppered crab and spiced rice. This burden, these threats. Erewhon had been planning this for decades. Maybe for centuries, while he'd slept, he'd planned all this out. And she was to be given nothing more than obscure commands by long-dead royals to find a way to stop it. Nothing more than God's damned months to rally a force against him. She doubted it was a coincidence that Maeve was sailing for Eelway at the same moment Brannan had commanded she go to the Stone Marshes on its southwestern peninsula. Or that the God's damned Morath fleet was squatting in the Gulf of Oro, right on its other side. There was not enough time. Not enough time to do what she needed to fix things. But small steps. She had Rolf to deal with, the little matter of securing his people's alliance, and the map she still needed to persuade him to use, to assist her in tracking down that lock. But first, best to ensure that infernal map actually worked. Chapter 29. Too many animals loitering about the streets at this hour would attract the wrong sort of attention. But Adian still wished that the shifter was wearing fur or feathers compared to this. Not that she was sore on the eyes as an auburn-haired and green-eyed young woman. She could have passed for one of the lovely mountain maidens of Northern Terrasen with that coloring. It was who Lysandra was supposed to be, as they waited just inside an alley. Who he was supposed to be, too. Lysandra leaned against the brick wall, a foot propped against it to reveal a length of creamy white thigh. And Adian, with his hand braced against the wall beside her head, was no more than an hourly customer. No sound in the alley but scuttling rats digging through rotten, discarded fruit. Skull's Bay was precisely the shithole he expected it to be, right down to its pirate lord, who now unwittingly held the only map to the lock that Aelin had been commanded to find. When Adian had complained that, of course, it was a map they could not steal, Rowan had been the one to suggest this plan, trap, whatever it was. He glanced at the delicate gold chain dangling around Lysandra's pale throat, tracing its length down the front of her bodice, to where the amulet of Orinth was now hidden beneath.
Admiring the view?
Adian snapped his eyes up from the generous swells of her breasts.
Sorry.
But the shifter somehow saw the thoughts churning in his head.
You think this won't work?
I think there are plenty of valuable things on this island. Why would Rolf bother to go after this?
Storms, enemies, and treasure. That was what the map showed. And since he and Lysandra were not the first two, only one, it seemed, would be able to appear on that map inked on Rolf's hands.
Rowan claimed Rolf would find the amulet interesting enough to go after it.
Rowan and Aelin have a tendency to say one thing and mean something else entirely.
Adian heaved a breath through his nose.
We've already been here an hour.
She arched an auburn brow. Do you have somewhere else to be?
You're tired.
We're all tired,
she said sharply. He shut his mouth, not wanting his head ripped off just yet. Each shift took something out of Lysandra. The bigger the change, the bigger the animal, the steeper the cost.
Adian had witnessed her morph from butterfly to bumblebee to hummingbird to bat within the span of a few minutes. But going from human to ghost leopard to bear or elk or horse, she'd once demonstrated, took longer between shifts, the magic having to draw up the strength to become that size, to fill the body with all its inherent power.
Casual footsteps sounded, accented by a two-note whistle. Lysandra's breath brushed against his jaw at the sound. Adian, however, stiffened slightly as those steps grew closer, and he found himself staring at the son of his great enemy. King now. But still a face he'd hated, sneered at, debated cutting into tiny pieces for many, many years. A face he'd seen drunk out of his mind at parties mere seasons ago. A face he'd seen buried against the necks of women whose names he'd never bothered to learn. A face that had taunted him in that dungeon cell. That face was now hooded. And for all the world, he looked like he was here to inquire about Lysandra's services, once Adian had finished with her. The general clenched his teeth.
What?
Dorian looked over Lysandra, as if surveying the goods, and Adian fought the urge to bristle.
Rowan sent me to see if you had any developments.
The prince and Aelin were back at the inn, drinking in the dining room, where all of Rolf's spying eyes might see and report them. Dorian blinked at the shifter, starting.
And gods above, you really can take on any human form.
Lysandra shrugged, the irreverent street whore debating her rate.
It's not as interesting as you'd think. I'd like to see if I could become a plant, or a bit of wind.
Can you do that? Of course she can, Adian said, pushing off the wall and crossing his arms.
No,
Lysandra said, cutting a glare in Adian's direction.
And there's nothing to report, not even a whiff of Rolf or his men.
Dorian nodded, sliding his hands into his pockets. Silence. Adian's ankle barked in pain as Lysandra subtly kicked him. He reined in his scowl as he said to the king,
So, you and Whitethorn didn't kill each other.
Dorian's brows scrunched.
He saved my life. Nearly got himself burned out to do it. Why should I be anything but grateful?
Lysandra gave Adian a smug smile. But the king asked him,
Are you going to see your father?
Adian cringed. He'd been glad for their venture tonight to avoid deciding. Aelin hadn't brought it up, and he had been content to come out here, even if it put him at risk of running into the mail.
Of course I'll see him, Adian said tightly.
Lysandra's moon-white face was calm, steady as she watched him, the face of a woman trained to listen to men, to never show surprise. He did not resent what she had been, what she portrayed now, only the monsters who had seen the beauty the child would grow into and taken her into that brothel. Aelin had told him what Erebin had done to the man she'd loved. It was a miracle the shifter could smile at all. Adian jerked his chin at Dorian.
Go tell Aelin and Rowan we don't need their hovering. We can manage on our own.
Dorian stiffened, but backed down the alley, no more than a disgruntled would-be customer. Lysandra shoved a hand against Adian's chest and hissed, "That man has endured enough, Adian. A little kindness wouldn't kill you."
"He stabbed Aelin. If you knew him as I have, you wouldn't be so willing to fawn over..."
"No one expects you to fawn over him, but a kind word, some respect..." He rolled his eyes.
"Keep your voice down."
She did, but went on. "He was enslaved. He was tortured for months, not just by his father, but by that thing inside of him. He was violated. And even if you cannot draw up forgiveness for stabbing Aelin against his own will, then try to have some compassion for that." Adian's heart stuttered at the anger and pain on her face, and that word she'd used. He swallowed hard, checking the street behind them. No sign of anyone hunting for the treasure they bore.
"I knew Dorian as a reckless, arrogant..."
"I knew your queen as the same. We were children then. We are allowed to make mistakes, to figure out who we wish to be. If you will allow Aelin the gift of your acceptance..."
"I don't care if he was as arrogant and vain as Aelin. I don't care if he was enslaved to a demon that took his mind. I look at him and see my family butchered, see those tracks to the river, and hear Quinn tell me that Aelin was drowned and dead."
His breathing was uneven, and his throat burned, but he ignored it. Lysandra said, "Aelin forgave him. Aelin never once held it against him." Adian snarled at her. Lysandra snarled right back and held his stare with the face not trained or built for bedrooms, but the true one beneath. Wild and unbroken and indomitable. No matter what body she wore, she was the Staghorn's given form, the heart of Oakwald. Adian said hoarsely,
"I'll try."
"Try harder. Try better." Adian braced his palm against the wall again and leaned in to glower in her face. She did not yield an inch.
"There is an order and rank in our court, lady. And last I checked, you were not number 3. You don't give me commands."
"This isn't a battlefield," Lysandra hissed. "Any ranks are formalities. And the last I checked..." She poked his chest, right between his pectorals, and he could have sworn the tip of a claw pierced the skin beneath his clothes. "You weren't pathetic enough to enforce rank to hide from being in the wrong." His blood sparked and thrummed. Adian found himself taking in the sensuous curves of her mouth, now pressed thin with anger. The hot temper in her eyes faded, and as she retracted her finger as if she'd been burned, he froze at the panic that filled her features instead.
"Shit. Shit."
Lysandra backed away a step, too casual to be anything but a calculated move. But Adian tried. For her sake, he tried to stop thinking about her mouth.
"You truly want to meet your father?"
she asked calmly. Too calmly. He nodded, swallowing hard. Too soon. She wouldn't want a man's touch for a long time. Maybe forever. And he'd be damned if he pushed her into it before she wanted to. And gods above, if Lysandra ever looked at any man with interest like that, he'd be glad for her. Glad she was choosing for herself, even if it wasn't him she picked. Adian swallowed, forcing himself to remember what she'd asked. His father, right.
"Did he want to see me?"
was all he could think to ask. She cocked her head to the side, the movement so feline he wondered if she was spending too much time in that ghost leopard's fur. He nearly bit Aelin's head off when she refused to tell him where and who you are. Ice filled his veins. If his father had been rude to her. But I got the sense, Lysandra quickly clarified as he tensed, that he is the sort of male who would respect your wishes if you chose not to see him. Yet in this small town, with the company we're keeping, that might prove impossible.
Did you also get the sense that it could persuade him to help us? Knowing me?
I don't think Aelin would ever ask that of you, Lysandra said, laying a hand on the arm still braced beside her head.
What do I even say to him? Adian murmured. I've heard so many stories about him. The Lion of Dorinel. He's a goddamned white knight. I don't think he'll approve of a son most people call Otterlin's whore.
She clicked her tongue, but Adian pinned her with a look.
What would you do?
I can't answer that question. My own father. She shook her head. He knew about that. The shifter father who had either abandoned her mother or not even known she was pregnant. And then the mother who had thrown Lysandra into the street when she discovered her heritage. Adian, what do you want to do? Not for us, not for Terrison, but for you. He bowed his head a bit, glancing sidelong at the quiet street again.
My whole life has been not about what I want. I don't know how to choose those things.
No. From the moment he'd arrived in Terrison at age 5, he'd been trained, his path chosen. And when Terrison had burned beneath Otterlin's touches, another hand had gripped the leash of his fate. Even now, with war upon them, had he truly never wanted something for himself? All he'd wanted had been the blood oath, and Aelin had given that away to Rowan. He didn't resent her for it, not anymore, but he had not realized he had asked for so little. Lysandra said quietly, I know. I know what that feels like. He lifted his head, finding her green eyes again in the darkness. He sometimes wished Erebin Hommel were still alive, just so he could kill the Assassin King himself. Tomorrow morning, he murmured.
Will you come with me? To see him?
She was quiet for a moment before she said, You really want me to go with you? He did. He couldn't explain why, but he wanted her there. She got under his skin so damn easily, but Lysandra steadied him. Perhaps because she was something new, something he had not encountered, had not filled with hope and pain and wishes. Not too many of them, at least.
If you wouldn't mind. Yes. I want you there.
She didn't respond. He opened his mouth, but steps sounded. Light. Too casual. They ducked deeper into the shadows of the alley, its dead-end wall looming behind them. If this went poorly... If it went poorly, he had a shapeshifter capable of shredding apart droves of men at his side. Adian flashed Lysandra a grin as he leaned over her once more, his nose within grazing distance of her neck. Those steps neared, and Lysandra loosed a breath, her body going pliant. From the shadows of his hood, he monitored the alley ahead, the shadows and shafts of moonlight, bracing himself. They'd picked the dead-end alley for a reason. The girl realized her mistake a step too late. Oh. Adian looked up, his own features hidden within his hood, as Lysandra purred to the young woman who perfectly matched Rowan's description of Rolf's barmaid.
I'll be done in 2 minutes, if you want to wait your turn.
Color stained the girl's cheeks, but she gave them a flinty look, scanning them from head to toe.
Wrong turn, she said. You sure?
Lysandra crooned.
A bit late in the evening for a stroll.
Rolf's barmaid fixed them with that sharp stare and sauntered back down the street. They waited. 1 minute. 5. 10. No others came. Adian at last pulled away, Lysandra now watching the alley entrance. The shifter wound an auburn curl around her finger.
She seems an unlikely thief.
Some would say similar things about you and Aelin.
Lysandra hummed in agreement. Adian mused.
Perhaps she was just a scout. Rolf's eyes.
Why bother? Why not just come take the thing?
Adian glanced again at the amulet that disappeared beneath Lysandra's bodice.
Maybe she thought she was looking for something else.
Lysandra, wisely, didn't fish the amulet of Orinth out from her dress. But his words hung between them, as they carefully picked their way back to the Ocean Rose. Chapter 30. After 2 weeks of inching across the muddy open plains, Elide was tired of using her mother's name. Tired of constantly being on alert to hear it barked by Molly to clean up after every meal. A mistake, no doubt, to have ever told the woman she had some experience washing dishes in busy kitchens. Tired of hearing Ombriel, the dark-haired beauty, not a carnival act at all, but Molly's niece and their moneykeeper, use it when questioning about how she'd hurt her leg, where her family came from, and how she'd learned to observe others so keenly that she could turn a coin as an oracle. At least Lorkin barely used it, as they'd hardly spoken while the caravan trudged through the mud-laden fields. The ground was so saturated with the daily afternoon summer rain that the wagons often became stuck. They'd barely covered any distance at all. And when Ombriel would catch Elide gazing northward, she'd ask, yet another recurring question, what lay in the north to draw her attention so frequently? Elide always lied, always evaded. The sleeping situation between Elide and her husband, fortunately, was more easily avoided. With the sodden earth, sleeping on it was nearly impossible. So the women laid out wherever they could in the 2 wagons, leaving the men to draw straws each night for who would get any remaining space, and who would sleep on the ground atop a makeshift floor of reeds. Lorkin, somehow, always got the short straw, either by his own devices, sleight of hand from Nick, who ran security and the nightly straw drawing, or simply from sheer bad luck. But at least it kept Lorkin far, far away from her, and kept their interactions to a minimum. Those few conversations they'd had, held when he escorted her to draw water from a swollen stream or gather whatever firewood could be found on the plain, weren't much to bother her either. He pressed her for more details regarding Morath, more information about the guards' clothes, the armies camped around it, the servants and witches. She'd started at the top of the keep, with the Aries and Wyverns and witches. Then she'd descended, floor by floor. It had taken them these 2 weeks to work their way down to the sublevels, and their companions had no idea that while the young married couple snuck off for more firewood, whispering sweet nothings was the last thing on their minds. When the caravan stopped that night, Elide aimed for a copse of trees in the heart of the field, to see what could be used at their large campfire. Lorkin trailed at her side, as quiet as the hissing grasses around them. The nickering of the horses and clamor of their companions readying for the evening meal faded behind, and Elide frowned as her boot sank deep into a pocket of mud. She yanked on it, ankle barking at bearing her weight, and gritted her teeth until Lorkin's magic pushed against her leg, an invisible hand freeing her boot, and she tumbled into him. His arm and side were as hard and unyielding as the magic he'd used, and she rebounded away, tall grass crunching beneath her.
"Thank you,"
she murmured. Lorkin stalked ahead and said without looking back,
"We finished at the three dungeons and their entrances yesterday night. Tell me about what's inside them."
Her mouth went a bit dry as she recalled the cell she'd squatted in, the darkness and tight air.
"I don't know what's inside,"
she lied, following him.
"Suffering people, no doubt."
Lorkin stooped, his dark head disappearing beneath a wave of grass. When he emerged, two sticks were gripped in his massive hands. He snapped them with little effort.
"You described everything else with no problem, yet your scent changed just now. Why?"
She strode past him, bending over and over to collect whatever scattered wood she could find.
"They did horrible things down there,"
she said over a shoulder.
"You could sometimes hear people screaming."
She prayed Terrison would be better.
It had to be.
"Who did they keep down there? Enemy soldiers?"
"Potential allies, no doubt, for whatever he planned to do."
"Whoever they wanted to torture."
The hands of those guards, their sneers.
"I assume you're going to leave as soon as I finish describing the last pit of Morath."
She plucked up stick after stick, ankle objecting with each shift in her balance.
"Is there a problem if I do? That was our bargain. I've stayed longer than I intended."
She turned, finding him with an armful of larger sticks. He unceremoniously dumped them into the small pile in her arms and thumbed free the hatchet at his side, before prowling to the curving fallen branch behind him.
"So am I just to play the abandoned wife, then?"
"You're already playing the oracle, so what difference does another role make?"
Lorkin brought his hatchet down upon the branch with a solid thwack. The blade sank unnervingly deep. Wood groaned.
"Describe the dungeons."
It was only fair, and it had been their bargain after all, his protection and help to get her out of harm's way, in exchange for what she knew. And he'd been complacent in all the lies she'd spun to their company. Quiet. But he'd gone along with it.
"The dungeons are gone,"
Elide managed to say.
"Or most of them should be. Along with the catacombs."
Thwack, thwack, thwack. Lorkin severed the branch, the wood yielding with a splintering cry. He set to cutting another section apart.
"Taken out in that blast?"
He lifted his axe, the muscles in his powerful back shifting beneath his dark shirt, but paused.
"You said you were near the courtyard when the blast happened. How do you know the dungeons are gone?"
Fine, she had lied about it, but the explosion came from the catacombs and took out some of the towers. One would assume the dungeons would be in its path, too.
"I don't make plans based on assumptions."
He resumed hacking apart the branch, and Elide rolled her eyes at his back.
"Tell me the layout of the northern dungeon."
Elide turned toward the sinking sun, staining the fields with orange and gold beyond them.
"Figure it out yourself."
The thud of metal on wood halted. Even the wind in the grasses died down. But she had endured death and despair and terror, and she had told him enough, turned over every horrible stone, looked around every dark corner at Morath for him. His rudeness, his arrogance. He could go to hell. She had barely set one foot into the swaying grasses when Lorkin was before her, no more than a lethal shadow himself. Even the sun seemed to avoid the broad plains of his tan face, though the wind dared ruffle the silken black strands of his hair across it.
"We have a bargain, girl."
Elide met that depthless gaze.
"You did not specify when I had to tell you, so I may take as much time as I wish to recall details, if you desire to wring every last one of them from me."
His teeth flashed.
"Do not toy with me."
"Or what?"
She stepped around him as if he were no more than a rock in a stream. Of course, walking with temper was a bit difficult when every other step was limping, but she kept her chin high.
"Kill me, hurt me, and you'll still be out of answers."
Faster than she could see, his arm lashed out, gripping her by the elbow.
"Marion,"
he growled. That name. She looked up at his harsh, wild face, a face born in a different age, a different world.
"Take your hand off me."
Lorkin, to her surprise, did so immediately. But his face did not change, not a flicker, as he said,
"You will tell me what I wish to know."
The thing in her pocket began thrumming and beating, a phantom heartbeat in her bones. Lorkin yielded a step, his nostrils flaring delicately, as if he could sense that stone awakening.
"What are you?"
he said quietly.
"I am nothing,"
she said, voice hollow. Maybe once she found Aelin and Adian, she'd find some purpose, some way to be of use to the world. For now, she was a messenger, a courier of the stone, to Selena Sardothian. However Elide might find one person in such an endless, vast world, she had to get north, and quickly.
"Why do you go to Aelin Galathinius?"
The question was too tense to be casual. No. Every inch of Lorkin's body seemed restrained, leashed rage and predatory instincts.
"You know the Queen,"
she breathed. He blinked. Not in surprise, but to buy himself time. He did know, and he was considering what to tell her, how to tell her.
"Selena Sardothian is in the Queen's service,"
he said.
"Your two paths are one. Find one and you'll find the other."
He paused, waiting. Would this be her life, then? Wretched people, always looking out for themselves, every kindness coming at a cost? Would her own queen at least gaze at her with warmth in her eyes? Would Aelin even remember her?
"Marion,"
he said again, the word laced with a growl. Her mother's name. Her mother. And her father. The last people who had looked at her with true affection. Even Finula, all those years locked in that tower, had always watched her with some mixture of pity and fear. She couldn't remember the last time she'd been held, or comforted, or smiled at with any genuine love for who she was. Words were suddenly hard. The energy to dredge up a lie or retort too much to bother with. So Elide ignored Lorkin's command and headed back toward the cluster of painted wagons. Manon had come for her, she reminded herself with each step. Manon and Asterin and Sorrel. But even they had left her alone in the woods. Pity, she reminded herself. Self-pity would do her no good. Not with so many miles between her and whatever shred of a future she stood a chance of finding. But even when she arrived, handed over her burden, and found Aelin, what could she offer? She couldn't even read gods above. The mere thought of explaining that to Aelin. To anyone. She'd think on it later. She'd wash the Queen's clothes if she had to. At least she didn't need to be literate for that. Elie didn't hear Lorkin this time as he approached, arms laden with massive logs.
"You will tell me what you know,"
he said through his teeth. She almost sighed, but he added,
"Once you are better."
She supposed that to him, sorrow and despair would be some sort of sickness.
"Fine."
"Fine,"
he said right back. Their companions were smiling when she and Lorkin returned. They had found dry ground on the other side of the wagons, solid enough for tents. Elide spied the one that had been raised for her and Lorkin, and wished it would rain. Lorkin had trained enough warriors to know when not to push. He'd tortured enough enemies to know when they were one slice or snap away from breaking in ways that would make them useless. So Marion, when her scent had changed, when he'd felt even the strange otherworldly power hidden in her blood shift to sorrow, worse, to hopelessness. He'd wanted to tell her not to bother with hope anyway. But she was barely into womanhood. Perhaps hope, foolish as it was, had gotten her out of Morath. At least her cleverness had, lies and all. He'd dealt with enough people, killed and bedded and fought alongside enough people, to know Marion wasn't wicked or conniving or wholly selfish. He wished she was, because it'd make it easier, make his task so much easier. But if she didn't tell him about Morath, if he broke her from pushing too much. He needed every advantage when he slipped into that keep, and when he slipped out again. She'd done it once. Perhaps Marion was the only person alive who had managed to escape. He was about to explain that to her, when he saw what she was staring at. The tent. Their tent. Ombriel came forward, throwing her usual wary glance his way, and slyly informed Elide they'd finally have a night alone together. Arms full of logs, Lorkin could only watch as that pale face of sorrow and despair transformed into youth and mischief, into blushing anticipation, as easily as if Marion had held up a mask. She even gave him a flirting glance before beaming at Ombriel, and rushing to dump her armful of sticks and twigs into the pit they'd cleared for the nightly fire. He possessed the good sense to at least smile at the woman who was supposed to be his wife, but by the time he'd followed to drop his own burden into the fire pit, she'd stalked off for the tent set a good distance away from the others. It was small, he realized with no tiny amount of horror. Probably meant for the sword-thrower who'd last used it. Marion's slim figure slipped through the white canvas flaps with hardly a ripple. Lorkin just frowned a bit before ducking inside. And remained ducking slightly. His head would go straight through the canvas if he stood to his full height. Woven mats atop gathered rushes covered the stuffy interior, and Marion stood on the other side of the tent, cringing at the sleeping roll on the makeshift floor. The tent probably had enough room for a proper bed and table, if need be. But unless they were camping longer than a night, he doubted they'd get any of those things.
"I'll sleep on the ground," he offered blandly. "You take the roll."
"What if someone comes in?"
"Then you'll say we got into a fight."
"Every night?"
Marion pivoted, her rich eyes meeting his. The cold, weary face was back. Lorkin considered her words.
"If someone walks into our tent without permission tonight, no one here will make the same mistake again."
He'd punished men in his war camps for less. but her eyes remained weary, wholly unimpressed and unmoved.
Fine,
she said again. Too close. Far too close to the edge of snapping entirely.
I could find some buckets. Heat water, and you could bathe in here if you want. I'll stand watch outside.
Creature comforts. To get her to trust him. Be grateful to him. To want to help him. To ease that dangerous brittleness. Indeed, Marian peered down at herself. The white shirt that was now dirt-flecked. The brown leather pants that were filthy. The boots.
I'll offer Umbriel a coin to wash it all for you tonight.
I have no other clothes to wear.
You can sleep without them.
Wariness faded in a flash of dismay.
With you in here?
He avoided the urge to roll his eyes. She blurted,
What about your own clothes?
What of them?
You... They're filthy, too.
I can wait another night.
She'd likely beg to sleep in the wagon if he was naked in here.
Why should I be the only one naked?
Wouldn't the ruse work better if you and I both took the opportunity at once?
You are very young,
he said carefully.
And I am very old.
How old?
She'd never asked.
Old.
She shrugged.
A body is a body. You reek as badly as I do. Go sleep outside if you won't wash.
A test. Not driven by any desire or logic, but to see if he'd listen to her. Who was in control? Get her a bath. Do as she asked. Let her get a sense of control over the situation. He gave her a thin smile.
Fine,
he echoed. When Lorcan pushed through the tent again, laden with water, he discovered Marian seated on the bedroll, boots off, that ruined ankle and foot stretched out before her. Her small hands were braced on the mangled, discolored flesh, as if she'd been rubbing the ache from it.
How badly does it hurt every day?
He sometimes used his magic to brace the ankle. When he remembered, which wasn't often. Marian's focus, however, went right to the steaming cauldron he'd set on the floor. Then the bucket he'd hauled over a shoulder for her to use as well.
I've had it since I was a child,
she said distantly, as if hypnotized by the clean water. She rose on uneven feet, wincing at her wrecked leg.
I learned to live with it.
That's not an answer.
Why do you even care?
The words were barely more than a breath, as she unbraided her long, thick hair, still fixated on the bath. He was curious. He wanted to know how and when and why. Marian was beautiful. Surely marring her like that had been done with some ill intent. Or to prevent something worse. She at last cut him a glance.
You said you'd stand watch. I thought you meant outside.
He snorted. Indeed he did.
Enjoy yourself,
he said, pushing out of the tent once more. Lorcan stood in the grasses, monitoring the busy camp, the wide bowl of the darkening sky. He hated the plains. Too much open space. Too much visibility. Behind him, his ears picked up the sigh and hiss of leather sliding down skin, the rustle of rough woven cloth being peeled off. Then fainter, softer sounds of more delicate fabric sliding away. Then silence, followed by a very, very quiet rustling. Like she didn't want even the gods hearing what she was doing. Hay crunched. Then a thud of the mattress roll lifting and falling. The little witch was hiding something. The hay snapped again as she returned to the cauldron. hiding something under the mattress. Something she'd been carrying with her and didn't want him knowing about. Water splashed, and Marianne let out a moan of surprising depth and sincerity. He shut out the sound. But even as he did, Lorkin's thoughts drifted toward Rowan and his bitch queen. Marianne and the queen were about the same age. One dark, one golden. Would the queen bother at all with Marianne once she arrived? Likely, if her curiosity was piqued about why she wished to see Selena Sardothian. But what about after? It wasn't his concern. He'd left his conscience on the cobblestones of the back streets of Doranel 5 centuries ago. He'd killed men who had begged for their lives, wrecked entire cities, and never once looked back at the smoldering rubble. Rowan had, too. God's damned Whitethorn had been his most effective general, assassin, and executioner for centuries. They had laid waste to kingdoms, and then drunk and bedded themselves into stupors in the following days-long celebrations on the ruins. This winter, he'd had a damn fine commander at his disposal, brutal and vicious and willing to do just about anything Lorkin ordered. The next time he'd seen Rowan, the prince had been roaring, desperate to fling himself into lethal darkness to save the life of a princess with no throne. Lorkin had known, in that moment. Lorkin had known, as he'd pinned Rowan into the grass outside Mistward, the prince thrashing and screaming for Aelin Galathinius, that everything was about to change. Knew that the commander he'd valued was altered irrevocably. No longer would they glut themselves on wine and women. No longer would Rowan gaze toward a horizon without some glimmer of longing in his eyes. Love had broken a perfect killing tool. Lorkin wondered if it would take him centuries more to stop being so pissed about it. And the queen, princess, whatever Aelin called herself, she was a fool. She could have bartered Athril's ring for Maeve's armies, for an alliance to wipe Morath off the earth. Even not knowing what the ring was, she could have used it to her advantage. But she'd chosen Rowan, a prince with no crown, no army, no allies. They deserved to perish together. Marian's soaked head popped out of the tent, and Lorkin twisted to see the heavy wool blanket wrapped around her like a gown.
"Can you bring the clothes now?"
She chucked her pile out. She'd bundled her underthings in her white shirt, and the leathers, they'd never be dry before morning, and would likely shrink beyond use if washed improperly. Lorkin stooped, picking up the bundle of clothes and trying not to peer into the tent to learn what she'd hidden beneath the bedroll.
"What about standing guard?"
Her hair was plastered to her head, heightening the sharp lines in her cheekbones, her fine nose. But her eyes were bright again, her full lips once more like a rosebud as she said,
"Please get them washed. Quickly."
Lorkin didn't bother confirming as he carried her clothes away from the tent, leaving her to sit in partial nakedness inside. Ombriel was in the middle of cooking whatever it was in the pot over the fire. Likely rabbit stew. Again. Lorkin examined the clothes in his hands. 30 minutes later, he returned to the tent, plate of food in hand. Marianne was perched on the bedroll, foot stretched out before her, blanket tucked under her shoulders. Her skin was so pale. He'd never seen such white, unmarred skin. As if she'd never been let outside. Her dark brows furrowed at the plate, then at the bundle under his arm.
"Ombriel was busy, so I washed your clothes myself."
She flushed.
"A body is a body," he repeated simply to her. "So are undergarments."
She frowned, but her attention was again riveted on the plate. He set it down before her.
I got you dinner, since I assumed you didn't want to sit among everyone in your blanket.
He dumped the pile of clothes on her bedroll.
And I got you clothes from Molly. She's charging you, of course, but at least you won't sleep naked.
She dug into the stew without so much as thanking him. Lorkin was about to leave when she said,
My uncle. He is a commander at Morath.
Lorkin froze and looked right to the bedroll. But Marion continued between bites.
He locked me in the dungeon once.
The wind in the grasses died. The campfire far beyond their tent flickered, the people around it huddling closer together, as the nighttime insects went silent, and the small, furred creatures of the plains scampered into their burrows. Marion either didn't notice the surge of his dark power, the magic kissed by death himself, or didn't care. She said,
His name is Vernon, and he is clever and cruel, and he will likely try to keep you alive if you are caught. He wields people to gain power for himself. He has no mercy, no soul. There is no moral code that guides him.
She went back to her food, done for the night. Lorkin said quietly,
Would you like me to kill him for you?
Her limpid dark eyes rose to his face. And for a moment, he could see the woman she'd become, was already becoming. Someone who, regardless of where she'd been born, any queen would prize at her side.
Would there be a cost?
Lorkin hid his smile. Smart, cunning little witch.
No,
he said, and meant it.
Why did he lock you in the dungeon?
Marion's white throat bobbed once, twice. She seemed to hold his stare through effort of will, through a refusal not to back down from him, but from her own fears.
Because he wished to see if his bloodline could be crossed with the Vog. That was why I was brought to Morath. To be bred like a prize mare.
Every thought emptied out of Lorkin's head. He had seen and dealt and endured many, many unspeakable things. But this...
Did he succeed?
He managed to ask.
Not with me. There were others before me who... Help came too late for them.
That explosion was not accidental, was it?
A small shake of the head.
You did it?
He glanced to the bedroll, to whatever she hid beneath. Again that shake of the head.
I will not say who or how. Not without risking the lives of the people who saved me.
Are the Ilken...
No. The Ilken are not the creatures that were bred in the catacombs. Those came from the mountains around Morath, through far darker methods.
Maeve had to know. She had to know what they were doing in Morath. The horrors being bred there, the army of demons and beasts to rival any from legend. She would never ally with such evil, never be foolish enough to ally with the Vog. Not when she warred with them millennia ago. But if she did not fight, how long would it be before these beasts were howling around Dorinel, before it was his own continent under siege? Dorinel could hold out. But he would likely be dead, once he found some way to destroy the keys and Maeve punished him. And with him dead and Whitethorn likely carrion too, how long would Dorinel last? Decades? Years? A question snagged in Lorkin's mind, drawing him to the present, to the stuffy little